This is day four of this July 2013 7-day session. We're reading from the teachings of Chinese Zen Master Xu Yun of the 19th and 20th centuries. He died in 1959, and he was expounding on the four noble truths, the fourth of which is the Noble Eightfold Path, which is a kind of a recipe or a prescription for release, freedom from the binds of this worldly life. I'm just going to hit a few points of his reciting of this Eightfold Path. He says the Eightfold Path guides, delimits, and establishes rules which are clear. Everyone can follow them. The first is right understanding. Understanding requires both study and consultation with a master. You would get an argument about that from in Japanese Zen, where at least for a while, monks, for their first period of training, they're not allowed to do any reading. I don't know about later, but generally, it's fair to say that there's more of encouragement for study in Chinese Zen than in Japanese Zen. In Japanese Zen, it's just all direct experience. And then Xu Yun says, information acquired only through reading is never sufficient. Is the book accurate? If it is, do we truly comprehend what we've read? We cannot test ourselves. Think of what would happen if students devised their own tests and graded them too. Every one of them would get an A, but how many of them would really know their subject? Many students of Chan read a book and then, by way of testing their comprehension, engage their friends in sophomoric arguments or regale them with lordly pronouncements. Teachers say of these discussions, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I'm thinking of newcomers to Zen who want to impress their friends. It's a waste of time. Xu Yun, a good teacher is indispensable. A good teacher engages us and determines if we understand what we've studied. There is no substitute for regular face-to-face interactions. And here another of his stories. You know, there was once a sailor who, while on leave, met the girl of his dreams. He fell madly in love with her. Unfortunately, he had to return to his ship to finish the 2 years of his enlistment. So he thought, I'll not let her forget me. I'll write to her every day. If nothing else, she'll love me for my fidelity. Every day, wherever he was, he wrote to her, and when he returned 2 years later, he learned that along about his 200th letter, she had married the mailman. And then, if in case the lesson is lost on us, he says, "Dear friends, don't be like that poor sailor who relied on the written word to achieve an understanding. Find a master who will meet regularly with you. Open your heart to him. The better he gets to know you, the better he will be able to advise and instruct you." The second step, the second of the Noble Eightfold Path is right thought. Well, I have to skip over a lot of this stuff. Right thought, you know, in Zen, right thought is no thought. Pretty much. That's it. He suggests being aware of our motivations, inquiring why we want something, why we want to do something, but that just stimulates a lot of thoughts, and it's too analytical. It's too much like therapy. And then he tells another long story, but anyway, the third step is right speech. How often do we impress words into the ego's service? To gain some advantage, we gossip, or we exaggerate, or we neglect to tell the whole story, or we insinuate the probable guilt of others while protesting our own innocence. Sometimes, just to be the center of attention, some of us will tell sordid tales or jokes. We think that words are not deeds, that they have little power in a short life, that somehow words just evaporate with the breath that speaks them. But words do have power, and they can live forever, and furthermore, they can heal as well as harm. Someone once said, I don't remember who this was, that speech either harms or helps. If it doesn't help, it harms. In other words, there's no neutral speech. Just as the rule of right speech discourages us from uttering falsehoods, insults, accusations, or from bragging about our own accomplishments, it also encourages us to speak words of comfort, to utter words of forgiveness, to express acknowledgement and appreciation for the accomplishments of others. The fourth of this Eightfold Path is right action. And here he pretty much just describes the first five of the 10 cardinal precepts. And I've so often given teishos on the precepts that I'll just skip around here, just because I feel obliged to pass on some of what he says. So the first five of the precepts are not to kill, not to take what is not given, not to misuse sexuality, not to lie, and not to cause others to abuse alcohol or drugs or do so oneself. So number one, the vow to be nonviolent. This does not mean that he cannot defend his life or the lives of those persons who are in his care, but that he cannot initiate hostile actions against others. But what about himself? He also is one of the people against whom he may take no hostile action. So I guess he's referring to suicide. Peace is not merely the absence of war. Anxiety is not an aggressive state, but it isn't peaceful either. The person who's in a coma is not at war, but he's not at peace either. Peace is a state that is deliberately achieved and maintained. It is not enough merely to be nonviolent. We must also act to promote harmony, well-being, and good health. Smoking, for example, is contrary not only to the smoker's health, but to the health of all around him. on both counts, then, smoking is forbidden by the precept against violence. I've never heard it this precept interpreted to include smoking. Whenever possible, a Buddhist should abstain from eating meat. I say whenever possible because this rule is not absolute. Many people, for example, live in Arctic regions where they have no choice but to eat fish and other marine creatures. They cannot grow gardens in the tundra, and we cannot deny the Dharma to human beings because their environment does not conduce to vegetarian diets. But where vegetables are plentiful, there is no reason to eat meat. Recently, someone gave me a small book about a remarkable Tibetan Lama who it seems was quite famous in Tibet for being strict about vegetarianism. Tibet might be one of the places that Xu Yun is referring to here, where it's so hard to refrain from eating meat because there isn't much that can grow. That's what made this case of this Lama so remarkable, is that he was very strong about it. Now, the second of the five grave precepts, to be truthful, not only in his social life, but in his business life as well. All forms of cheating and chicanery are included in this precept. Whenever we sacrifice truth in order to gain some imagined advantage, we enter a tangled, convoluted world. It's that old saying, what a web we weave when we set out to deceive. Once, long ago, at the center, a couple of people in the Sangha got together and she ended up pregnant, Roshi commented, "What a web we weave when we set out to conceive." The third one, the Buddhist vows not to appropriate property which is not his own. This is the precept against stealing. Some people think that this precept involves only cat burglars and pickpockets. So long as they are not breaking and entering or purse snatching, they think they needn't worry about this precept. But what is an unpaid debt? Is this not stealing? What is borrowing something and not returning it? Isn't this stealing? What is using another person's property and damaging it without compensating him for the damage? Isn't this stealing? It is because we excuse or overlook our own little larcenies that we feel no need to repent of them. According to ancient wisdom, the thief is sorry he is to be hanged, not that he is a thief. And then Xu Yun assures us, if before we committed any act we examined its ethics and its possible results, we would never need to worry about the gallows. The fourth one, vows to be sexually moral, modest, and responsible. In this one precept, we can see how easy it is to break all the others. In the cause of his lust, a man will steal. In the cause of his lust, he will ply the woman he desires with alcohol and deceive her with false promises. And when he uses and abuses her in such a way, is he not harming her? So these are the three or four of the other grave precepts. and as greatly as we condemn immorality, so greatly do we praise morality. Much honor attends the virtuous person, the person who is chaste in his single life or faithful to his marriage vows. It is not easy for a man to overcome lust. The temptations are ubiquitous and infinite in variety. Yet if anyone were to divert some of the energy he squanders on sexual conquests into conquering his own lust, he would make true spiritual progress. All honorable men concur on the struggle's severity. Even the Buddha said, "If I had had another obstacle as difficult to overcome as my sexuality, I never would have made it." I never heard him say that he had said that. And then Xu Yun says, "The Buddha's good humor and self-deprecating candor should give us all encouragement." And then fifth, the Buddhist vows to abstain from the use of alcohol or other intoxicants. There are those who say an occasional drink won't hurt anyone. But an occasional drinker is still a drinker. It is rather like the state of being a little pregnant. Either there is a pregnancy or there isn't. Well, many of us would take issue with this stance of his, certainly for celibate monks. Traditionally it would be complete abstaining from alcohol. The description "occasional" is an unlocked door which any thief can enter. Either sobriety's door is locked or it isn't. Experience tells us that the best way to solve a problem is to avoid it. Complete abstention is the best way to observe and guard this precept. The occasional drinker can remain sober when he's not beset by problems, but as soon as he's under serious stress, he may easily succumb to the dead-end escape of alcohol. Once he is captured by drink, he discovers that one drink is too many and 100 drinks are not enough. Alcohol relaxes our inhibitions so that we may indulge our egos. It allows us to override the rules of decorum and decency and then to blame our misconduct on the drink, not on our having taken the drink in the first place. Of course, we tell ourselves that we took that drink in order to enjoy ourselves, but when we drink and dull our senses, how can we enjoy a pleasure? Lady Astor, who used to spar with Winston Churchill, she once said, "I don't drink because I want to know when I'm having a good time." Oh yeah, and then he says, "And even if we could, what value is there in experiencing a pleasure that we cannot later remember or savor?" We often find that an intoxicated person who commits an immoral act will afterwards, when sober again, regard himself with disgust. But then the same man will use that self-disgust as an excuse to drink again. So that those are the five precepts of that he's putting under right action, and then the next of the noble eightfold path is right livelihood, and I'll sort of skip over this. It's not the best match for Sashin Taisho. He just says what everyone here knows. Honest work is honest work. There are no noble occupations and no ignoble occupations. And then he talks about the caste system in India in the time of the Buddha, and how the Buddha rejected it and went out of his way to associate with the so-called untouchables. The sixth of the Eightfold Path is right effort. We exert right effort when we discontinue bad habits and practice and develop good ones. This is easier to say than to do. There's that word habit again. The longer I practice Zen, the more I appreciate what a rich and powerful word that is, the meaning behind habit. It's really our work in spiritual practice is working to purify our habit forces, habits of reacting to people and situations, the ways we habitually react, the ways that we react in the mind, just our own thoughts. I went through a period of time when I really pondered what character means. What is character? We have to reject that it is anything permanent, because there is nothing permanent. Everything, to one degree or another, is in a process of change, of flux. So there is no permanent substance that we can call one's the character one is stuck with. But we also know that that we can struggle with things in ourselves that can take a long time to overcome. And I think really the best way to understand character is it's habit energy. Habit energy is not unchanging, but it can be stubborn, it can be resistant to change. When someone has caused suffering to others through egoistic behavior, at what point, and then to see the person claims to have changed, it's put behind him, but at what point can we be sure that he or she won't repeat that behavior, won't get drawn back into what was a habit of the past? You see this with politicians who do some spectacular, create some spectacular scandal, and then they disappear for a while, and then they come back and ask the voters to give them another chance. I think that at the least we have to expect that such a person will show contrition and real regret. If they don't express that, then there isn't much we can expect in the way of change. But even if they do, and this goes especially for politicians who will often say anything to get reelected, how much can we trust an expression of regret? and remorse. And of course, it's not just politicians. It's missteps that anyone can make, and then yeah. Let me repeat this. We exert right effort when we discontinue bad habits and practices and develop good ones. Well, this goes back to the same thing. Our relationship to thoughts that arise in the mind. This is possibly the ultimate addiction, is human beings' addiction to their thoughts. And it takes practice. It takes many, many trials, countless trials to develop the ability to refrain from thoughts, getting involved in thoughts. This is practice. This is Zen practice. It's getting drawn into our thoughts and then realizing it and getting back to the practice, and then again and again and again. He says, in Chan, we must become aware that every breath we take provides us with an opportunity for practice. There it is. In Sesshin, one of the most difficult places to apply this is, every time we leave the Zendo. Break periods, exercise period, work period, we find the mind continually getting away from us. But what choice do we have but just to go back over and over and over without getting discouraged? Without getting down on ourselves, getting negative, but just persistently returning. Or as they say in some of these Chinese texts, rejecting the false and returning to the true. He continues, people think the world intrudes on them. They do not understand that they are the gatekeepers of their own minds, that they can easily shut and lock the doors to their minds. If people intrude, it is because the gatekeeper has left the doors open. This is an ancient metaphor in Zen of keeping the sense gates closed. Not just Zen, in Buddhism, you hear actually more in other kinds of Buddhist meditation than Zen, but the six sense doors are the six faculties of the senses, what we think of as the five main senses, seeing, hearing, and so forth, plus the sixth, which is thinking. In Sesshin, we do this more than any other time, for sure, keeping the eyes down. He continues, some people who cannot control their own minds strive instead to control the minds of others. I wonder if he's referring to Mao Zedong, who had such an impact on his life, Xu Yun's life. They find it less daunting to try to direct the thoughts of hundreds of other people than to direct their own thoughts. This situation is what the Buddha had in mind when he said that the man who conquers 10,000 men in battle is not so great a hero as the man who conquers himself. This is another famous comparison of the Buddha. Pointing to how difficult it is to conquer our own thoughts, that is, to get free of them. Every day in all our interactions, we must act to further our goal of enlightenment and self-awareness. If we have acquaintances whose company leads us easily into error, we should avoid contact with those acquaintances. If we have insufficient time to meditate because we're too busy with clubs or hobbies or sports, we should cut back those activities. Spiritual composure is gained by practice. A very wise man once noted that the mind of a true person of Zen cannot be distressed or intimidated because, whether in good times or bad, it simply continues at its own steady pace, like a clock ticking in a thunderstorm. I like that. We should all try to be like clocks that, even in thunderstorms, just keep on ticking. Or to paraphrase the words of the poet Shelley, practice teaches us to become like that smooth spot of glassy quiet mid those battling tides. The seventh of the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. Just a little bit here. In addition to observing the disciplined thoughts, in addition to observing the disciplined thoughts required to discriminate the real from the false, we must also remain mindful of the causes and effects of all our actions. Dear friends, we should never allow a day to pass without reflecting upon our conduct. Have we done all we could to be kind and helpful to others, to put them at ease? Have we acted in ways that are contrary to the Buddha Dharma? Have we been petty or mean, proud or lazy, gluttonous or greedy, jealous or angry? Well, in Zen practice, this kind of thinking back, reflecting back on our days is not something we need to do as a special practice, because it's likely some of this happens just in sitting. In sitting in silence, these things can bubble up into our awareness, these ways in which we betrayed our true nature and how we reacted to others, how we conducted ourselves. Happens, certainly it happens in Sesshin, in the depths of the silence of Sesshin, being reminded of ways that we went astray. But in the Zen that I learned and teach, it's not something that we sit back and do a remembrance of. We don't need to if when we quiet the mind. And he presents a nice analogy here. At night, first he says, it is not easy to see our own faults. Sometimes we strain to detect them, but can see nothing. At night, if we stand in a brightly lit room and try to look out a window at the dark landscape, all we'll see is our reflection in the glass. We'll see nothing more than what we already know, the image of ourselves, and that small, confined space in which we are enclosed. If we want to see beyond ourselves, we have to turn off the lights. We have to dim our egos or shut them off entirely. only then will we be able to see through the glass. The image of light as the light of the discriminating mind is a fairly common one we see in Zen. In many religions, it's all about avoiding the dark and going toward the light. Well, there's some of that in Zen also, but the image is also used of light as our wanting to reach beyond the light of the discriminating mind into what is beyond it. In a way, we can say that's what Zen practice, every Zen practice, breath, koan, everything, in a way you could say is delivering us into the darkness of not knowing. This is the womb of wisdom, the cave of true understanding. And then he finally gets to the eighth of the Eightfold Path, which is right meditation. And he talks about the koan. In China, they usually refer not to the koan, or the Chinese, koan is a Japanese word, the Chinese word is kungan, but they more commonly refer to the huado. The huado is the nub of the koan. So with the koan mu, the whole koan is the story about the monk who asks Joshu, does even a dog have Buddha nature? To which Joshu replies, mu. But the nub of it, the huado, is just the word mu. So, but we usually use that as, we usually, when we say the koan, we usually mean the nub of it. So I'm just going to substitute, instead of saying wado, I'm going to say the koan. And he says, dear friends, according to ancient wisdom, if one wishes to be happy for an hour, he eats a good meal. If he wishes to be happy for a year, he marries. I love that one. If he wishes to be happy for a lifetime, he grows a garden. If he wishes to be happy for eternity, he examines a koan. What then is a koan? Yeah, he really is talking about the nub of it. Huado means, literally means head word. It's a statement, he says, designed to concentrate our thoughts upon a single point, a point that exists in the head of the original mind, a point immediately before the thought enters our ego consciousness, our intellect. It is a source thought. In ancient times, it was regarded as sufficient merely to point to the stilled mind in order to realize Buddha nature. I think this is, he's really talking about shikantaza, just sitting without any object of concentration. Bodhidharma spoke of quieting the mind, and the sixth patriarch talked about perceiving self-nature. Both advocated a simple recognition of the mind's true state of undefiled purity. Again, I think he's referring to shikantaza. But pointing wasn't as simple as it sounded. As the years passed and Zen became popular, people with differing degrees of ability were attracted to it. Many practitioners claim to have found easy ways to reach exalted states of enlightenment. They boasted of possessing the Dharma's precious jewels, but the jewels they described, they had merely seen in the possession of others. True Chan masters could, of course, see right through such false claims, but beginners couldn't always tell a lie from the truth. The masters worried about the confusing effect such bad information was having on new practitioners, decided to devise methods of authenticating and standardizing accomplishments. And one of the methods they devised was the koan. Never heard this explanation of how koans originated. And he takes as an example the koan, who is it who now repeats the Buddha's name? Now this is something that I've never heard of done in Japan or in our own country. It represents a kind of an amalgam of two different things, Zen and the Pure Land practice. The Pure Land Buddhism is another kind of Buddhism. It's not Zen. And in Pure Land Buddhism, the primary practice is to recite the name of Amida Buddha. And there's a formula for doing that. Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu. I place my faith in Amida Buddha. Hakuin, among others, would very strongly discourage people from combining Zen and Pure Land practices, but Shu Yun recommended it, and so he combined them by making a koan out of the reciting of the name of Amida Buddha, and that's it. Who is it who now repeats the Buddha's name? Because we don't offer that or recommend it, I'm just going to kind of translate here into the most widely used koan for among first koans, which is what is Mu, and just sort of substitute here for what he's saying. Regardless of how the question is stated, the answer must be found in the same place it originated. In the source, the true self, the ego cannot answer it. Talking here about what is Mu, or who am I, or what is this, or what is it. Obviously, quick and facile answers are worthless. When asked what is Mu, we may not retort, it is Mu, Mu is Mu, and let it go at that. We have to continue our questioning and our confrontations. A civil war goes on inside our mind. The ego fights the ego. Sometimes the ego wins, and sometimes the ego loses. He's being funny again. There aren't two of them. There's not even one. On and on we battle. What is it that makes my mind conscious of being me? What is my mind anyway? What is consciousness? Well, these things can sometimes get involved when we're asking these basic primary koans. Sometimes we may want to quit working on the koan, but we find we can't get it out of our mind. The bell won't ring and let us rest. He's referring to the boxers. If you don't like pugilistic metaphors, you could say that the koan begins to haunt us like a melody that we just can't stop humming. Oh, who hasn't had that happen in Sesshin, where a song comes into your mind, usually some old, hideous, sticky song. Needless to say, a koan should never degenerate into an empty expression. Many people think they can shadowbox with their koan and just go through the motions of engagement. While their minds are elsewhere, their lips say, "What is mu? What is mu? What is mu? What is this? What is this? Who am I?" This is the way of parrots, not of Zen practitioners. The koan has meaning. It is a question that has an answer that we must be determined to, and we must be determined to find that answer. He would agree, now, just to put a finer point on this, that there's not really an answer to any koan. It's not an answer in the ordinary sense of an answer. But there we come to an understanding of it. We don't need an answer as such, an answer that we could write out on a piece of paper. We don't need an answer when we grow into the koan, and that's how we come to understand it. We have to become the koan, not figure it out. You can't figure out a koan. The phrase "figure out" implies using the brain, using our intellect. No one has ever figured out mu. No one has ever figured out who am I, what am I. But you don't need to figure it out. You grow into it, you become it, and then you know it. You know it with a capital K, know. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.